From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Ray Suarez of Al Jazeera America, in for Tom Ashbrook. And this is On Point. There's a lot of talk this month about how the GOP may be imploding. But author and historian Thomas Frank will tell you the Democratic Party isn't doing so well either. As Frank sees it, the women and men who run the Democratic Party today have forgotten what life is like for the average working-class or middle-class American. They've bought into the idea that what's good for Wall Street is good for the country, that the educations that made them comfortable, upwardly mobile, are the answer for everybody, Frank says. And they're wrong. This hour on Point, a liberal's hard critique of the new Democratic Party. You can join us on air or online. What do you see in the so-called New Democrats from Bill Clinton on? Did liberals betray their historic base? Join us anytime on atpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me from Washington is Thomas Frank, founding editor of The Baffler, contributor to Salon, former columnist for The Wall Street Journal, author of The Wrecking Crew, What's the Matter with Kansas, and more. His new book is called Listen, Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People, and you can find an excerpt on our website, onpointradio.org. Thomas Frank, welcome to On Point.
Hey, how are you doing today, Ray?
The case you make in your book is very tough on how the Democratic Party and liberals in America in general responded to the big changes happening in the economy of the United States and the economy of the world. Would you go as far as to say that a lot of those changes wouldn't have had the effects they had in the United States if liberals, if the Democratic Party had responded differently?
Oh, that's absolutely the case. Yeah. That is definitely what I think. One of the sort of the great fallacies that you see when you talk to liberals or when you read Democratic Party materials is this idea that globalization and technology are just things that happen to us. You know, things that we can do nothing about. And in fact, globalization, you know, is defined by these various free trade treaties, I should say so-called free trade treaties, that are thousands of pages long with every detail, you know, fought over and negotiated over. And then they tell us that, you know, well, that's just globalization. That's God did that to you. You know, and the same with technology. You know, the technology is supposed to be this kind of unmoved mover. There's nothing we can do about it, you know. But in fact, you know, technology, a lot of the great technological advances of our times are just ways of circumventing existing rules. You know, that's why they're so profitable. That's why they're so prosperous. Or they're ways of achieving monopoly, you know, things like that. And they're only successful because we don't enforce those laws that they've circumvented. We could if we felt like it, but we don't. But then our leaders just say, well, that's, you know, there's nothing you can do. It's not, you know, it's not us bidding your wages down. It's technology, and this is just progress, and there's nothing you can do about it. And that's, you know, that's who the Democrats are today. They really believe that stuff.
Well, nothing you can do seems a little supine. I'll take your point there. But I'm wondering what an empowered, not enfeebled, liberal movement, Democratic Party, would have said to a General Motors that wanted to build transmissions in Brazil, to a Motorola that wanted to have much of the guts of their telephones made in Southeast Asia, to a Molex that moved much of its production from the Midwest to China. Would you have just said, no, you can't do that? To global companies that have operations in many places in the world and then seek to do certain processes where the labor is cheaper, the United States, unlike other countries, would have said, no, I'm sorry, you just can't?
Well, there used to be, and there still are, all sorts of rules about what can be done here and what can't be done there. And I should say that they generally have to do with tariffs and stuff like that. We'll go back to NAFTA, which is the case that I talk about in Listen Liberal, the case that I go into in great detail. And what NAFTA was mainly about was, you know, companies had been making things in Mexico for a long time. I mean, American companies had been making things in Mexico for a long time. What NAFTA did is it secured those companies' property in their property investments in Mexico, so the Mexican government couldn't nationalize their property any longer. And this allowed them to move stuff to Mexico without any fear. Look, let me put it this way. There's 1,000 ways you can write a trade deal. Every trade deal benefits some people and harms other people. This is something that I discovered when I was doing the research for my book. All our trade deals are basically written to protect big pharma, right? These guys get the benefit of every doubt. Everything is written. Every trade deal we sign off on is, you know, goes a little bit further in protecting their intellectual property rights. Well, it doesn't have to be that way. That's something that hurts average Americans, you know, $1,000 a pill or whatever it is. Were you to write the trade deal so that you could, we could buy cheap, high-quality generic medicine made in India or somewhere like that, it would be really, really bad for big pharma, but it would be really, really, really good for the American public. It just depends on how you write these things. There's all sorts of ways that you can structure a trade deal to benefit some people and hurt others. And up until now, every single one we've done has been designed to hurt working Americans and to benefit, you know, the professional managerial class, people who own.
For a long time, the wage differential between American workers and workers in other places in the world was justified by the presence and the centrality of human beings to making things. You really needed people who knew what to do, knew how to do it, knew how to tend and operate machines. But during the time of the rise of the machine and the rise of the computer as a machine tender, the differential in the productivity between American workers and workers in other places in the world has really narrowed because, in part, they've moved the machines that do things to the places where workers are cheaper. How were we going to justify having a structurally high-wage economy when what other places in the world had to sell was willing workers at lower rates of pay?
Well, you should have a high-wage economy because we're human beings in this country. There are human beings in those countries as well, but this is not something that this is a basic demand that people have a right to make. You mentioned productivity. I'm going to tell you something that's just going to that's going to be a huge surprise. Productivity has been growing in America all through the period I described: the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, up into the present. Productivity has been growing. Wages haven't. Okay, in the decades after World War II, wages and productivity grew at exactly the same rate, or very close to exactly the same rate. When productivity went up, workers got paid more. Today, American productivity still goes up. It goes up all the time, but wages don't. Now, this is not because, you know, of the god of the market or the invisible hand. This is because management has more power than labor in this country. And one of the ways that they have more power is that they are able to threaten to move their factory to, you know, wherever, to move their production somewhere if workers make the slightest kind of demand on them. And that's it's a power relationship, Ray, is all I'm saying here. And I'm also saying that, to go back to what I said originally, people have a right to demand a middle class way of life, even if they don't hold advanced degrees. You know, we have a right to that as citizens, as human beings. Everyone does.
Well, you identify one of the hinge points of history when the Democrats became enamored of people with advanced degrees. What did you mean by that? And isn't what we've heard over and over and over again true, that people with better educations are more flexible, more productive, more useful? That's what we're told, and that's what kids in school are told day after day.
That an education is a good thing? Well, of course it is. Ray, I spent 25 years of my life getting an education. I went and got a PhD. and I'll tell you something. When I got done with that, I discovered that, they still wanted historians in America. They just didn't want to pay them. Okay, this is the famous academic job crisis where my discipline was being essentially Uberized avant la lettre, right? This is before Uber even existed. But what I did, the kind of, you know, highly educated labor, was being casualized. And this wasn't because you know, there was something wrong with my generation of PhDs. This was just because the power relationship had shifted. That's all it was. But of course, an education is a wonderful thing. But you asked the bigger question is this historical question. How did the Democrats move away from the working class, the middle class, and become so enamored of the professional class, of people with advanced degrees, these very tasteful people in the wealthy suburbs, you know, the artisanal everything? How'd this happen? And what's fascinating, and this is the story that I tell in Listen, Liberal. And what's fascinating about this story is that they did it right out in the open. They were, you know, right up front about this. They decided, and this it all began in the wake of the 1968 election when the Democratic Party was basically having a civil war over who they were and what they stood for. They decided that they were going to remove organized labor from their position of – they had a sort of structural position within the Democratic Party and embrace instead this highly educated, white-collar workers and, you know, professional workers in the new economy. Although they called it the post-industrial economy at the time. That was the term of art in those days. And they did this right out in the open. Everybody saw it happening and took their sides in this battle. But basically from that time up till this, if you read Democratic Party literature, they have this sort of constant love affair with this group of people, the professional class. They call them wired workers, the creative class, all these wonderful names for them.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the Democratic Party and its working voters and whether the party has abandoned them. You can join the conversation, have the free trade deals negotiated by, signed by Democratic presidents from Clinton to Obama served average Americans. Is the Democratic Party today offering a kind of trickle-down liberalism to voters? And are they right to? My guest, Thomas Frank, founding editor of The Baffler, contributor to Salon. His new book is called Listen, Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. Before the break, Thomas Frank was talking about the Democratic Party's recent love affair, affection for, extolling of the highly educated. What happens on the other side of that divide? In February, the Carrier Corporation, maker of air conditioners, announced its plan to move its Indianapolis manufacturing plant to Mexico. And you've heard Donald Trump say again and again he would order Carrier to keep its factories and its jobs in the United States. Here's the corporate manager telling his workers 1,400 of them would be out of a job.
Best way to stay competitive and protect the business for long term is to move production from our facility in Indianapolis to Monterrey, Mexico.
In 1993, then-President Bill Clinton signed the North America Free Trade Act, which was negotiated by the H.W. Bush administration. Clinton embraced a globalized economy and promised increased prosperity for all Americans.
In a few moments, I will sign the North American Free Trade Act into law. NAFTA will tear down trade barriers between our three nations. It will create the world's largest trade zone.
And create jobs. Thomas Frank, if you talk to the people who negotiated NAFTA and helped get it passed during both the Bush and Clinton years, they say the jobs that went were jobs that were on the chopping block anyway and eventually were going to be sucked out of the United States. This at least provided a rule book.
I'm sorry. That might be, Ray, but the thing is that NAFTA is NAFTA provided management a weapon to use against labor. Okay, NAFTA allowed managers all over America to threaten to move the plant to Mexico if they, you know, because everybody knows they can do it now. It's not a problem. They don't have to worry about having their property nationalized anymore. They can do it, and they use this threat all the time, a lot more now than they did in the days before NAFTA. And so, what this was about was disciplining labor. Okay, it was disciplining labor, and what's interesting is they did this. So one part of the American society gets the stick Another part gets the carrot. This is at the same time Bill Clinton is deregulating Wall Street. By the way, a series of deregulations all through his administration. The Clinton administration bailed out a hedge fund, Ray. So these guys get bailouts. They get the carrot, whereas average workers get to face that guy saying we're moving the facility to, you know, whatever it is. It's basically he is choosing one class of Americans over another class of Americans. And he did this constantly through his administration. And by the way, Barack Obama has done it too, with continuing the Wall Street bailouts that he inherited from George W. Bush, while at the same time doing nothing or almost nothing to help average homeowners hang on to their houses when it went into foreclosure.
One of those production workers for Carrier in Wisconsin losing his job, which will now be done by a Mexican, is a tragedy. And it's a tragedy that spins out through the care and the taxes paid on the home he lives in, the money that that person spends in the local economy. It is definitely a setback, a tragedy, a terrible event. But to compare it to a hedge fund, which has a pistol pointed at the temple of the economy that can destroy billions of dollars worth of equity if it spins out of control. They're tragedies, both of them, but of different magnitude, aren't they?
Wait a minute. You just said that if somebody has a pistol pointed at that, we have to just hand over our wallets? Come on, Ray. This is the United States. Now, by the way, I want to point something else out about NAFTA. Wait a minute. No, I don't. That's crazy. You're saying that if somebody is threatening us, the answer is to just to bail them out and give them whatever they want?
I'm not suggesting that. I'm just saying that the two events are different in their consequences and different in their urgency.
You're absolutely right about that. And I want to point out something else about NAFTA, which is this, and this is fascinating when you do the research on NAFTA. And by the way, we should remember NAFTA was just the first of these trade agreements, and there were many, many, many of them. But NAFTA was, it was the first one where the battle lines were drawn and it was, this big war. But it has been bad for Mexico as well, for average Mexicans. It really ruined the Mexican family farm, just, destroyed this industry. And it's also, by the way, unpopular in Canada. It's an amazing thing. It disciplined the workers of all three of these countries while, doing wonderful things for the sort of upper classes of these societies.
Let's go to the phones. Jordan is calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Jordan, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray. How are you?
Okay.
I have to say your guest has really hit the nail on the head. I'm a millennial voter. I'm 27 years old. And I have been, my entire adult life, I've worked for minimal pay. I've had to, my entire adult life, live from paycheck to paycheck, not being able to get appropriate health care, not being able to, having to wear, the same contacts for months on end, not being able to get dental care when I need it. And I've watched as the Democrats have really sat and done nothing. And this election cycle has exposed, I think, for me and so many others my age so much, where I used to feel like these two parties were these two different dragons, and I was watching these two different heads, fighting back and forth. And I feel now I've taken a few steps back, and what I'm seeing is that what I thought was two separate monsters are really fused at the same body.
Jordan, let me ask you a question. You're calling from Wisconsin, Jordan, which is the home of Briggs & Stratton, which has outsourced a lot of its production. There was a Chrysler plant in Kenosha that closed after Chrysler took it over from AMC. There was a big meatpacking industry in the southeastern part of the state that has also gone away. If the Democrats had taken a different tack toward politics, toward economics, would it have made your young working life a different matter? Would you have been doing better, do you think?
Absolutely. I mean, Milwaukee used to be a huge industrial town. It used to be filled with jobs, filled with factory jobs. And now all of the jobs that are left are service industry jobs, which pay little to nothing. And I look at, the fact that what has taken over now is service industry jobs, and nothing has been done for these people. And they ask for nothing but a living wage, a wage just enough so that they won't need, food stamps to feed themselves, and they're made fun of.
Thomas Frank?
Well, he's, you know, I know exactly what he's talking about. And these are some of the people that I feel the worst about when I was writing this book are young people just coming out of college now who did everything that they were supposed to do and, you know, went to college, studied so hard, and took out the loans, because you have to do that now because the price of college is spiraling out of control, just like the price of prescription drugs. The price of college is out of control, and so you wind up deeply in debt, and you come out and you discover that the labor market is gradually being casualized, the whole thing. There's one of the companies that is that sort of specializes in this is called TaskRabbit. I'm not sure if you're familiar with this, but I love that name, TaskRabbit. It's this gig economy has transformed us all into TaskRabbits. And I'll tell you a funny thing about it. So there's, you know, when President Obama first came in, he was much criticized for the revolving door between his administration and Wall Street. And that gradually sort of slowed down. But now the revolving door that is spinning at great speed is between his administration and Silicon Valley. And one of his – is it David Plouffe, who worked on his campaign in 2008, who now works for Uber? And basically they're selling Uber in the same way that he sold Barack Obama in 2008. You know, it's going to empower you as an individual, all this sort of thing. What it actually is doing is offering a way for management and consumers, by the way, people who ride in taxis, to get away, you know, to circumvent local safety rules for taxis and other things. I mean, it depends on the place. But this is what I want to get at. And this is the point of the book, and this is the point of everything I'm talking about. Every economic relationship is a political relationship. You know, Uber is not something that is rolling over our society because it's such a great idea. It is a good idea, by the way. It's very convenient. It's a wonderful idea. But we have, you know, our cities and states have the right, and I would say the obligation, to make sure that they play by the same rules as everybody else. And I would apply that to across the board to, you know, all of these companies that are, you know, all these innovation companies that our Democratic leaders love to, you know, to talk about. They talk about how wonderful they are, how creative they are, how innovative they are. They have to play by the same rules as everyone else.
Thomas, I want to bring another voice into the conversation. I guess precisely the kind of new Democrat that you've been critical of in the book. Joining us from Washington is Jim Kessler, co-founder and senior vice president for policy of the centrist Democratic think tank Third Way, a former aide to Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer of New York. He worked in Democratic politics since 1984 on Capitol Hill and on the campaign trail. Jim Kessler, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me, Ray.
Well, I guess to boil down Thomas Frank's argument to its essence, right to its nubs, things didn't have to go the way they did. Do you agree?
Well, let me tell you where I agree with him. So every time I hear Democrats talk about, we need to focus on the rising American electorate of, you know, women and minorities and millennials, I think that's great, but it also makes my blood boil because there's also a sinking American electorate, and that's the type of people that Professor Frank is talking about. But I do feel, you know, where I differ is I don't think it's possible to turn back the clock, and I think many of these trends were certainly inevitable. I mean, look, 150,000 people lost their jobs at Kodak, and it's not because of Mexico or because of a stacked deck. It's because you take pictures on your phone. And there's 550,000 people in the last 10 years who lost their jobs in the paper industry. It's because I'm the last person on earth that's reading a newspaper these days. And there's 450,000 people in the last 10 years who lost department store jobs. And it's because people shop online. And these trends, globalization, technology, and demography, the aging of the American population, these are huge global forces. They are, I don't think that they are going to change. And the big challenge is, how do we make those forces work for people instead of against people? I think that is the most difficult public policy challenge today in America.
Thomas Frank, how do you respond to that?
Well, I mean, yes, of course, there's technological progress. There's no question about that. And yes, newspapers are dying, as I know from from personal experience. And by the way, I thought I was the last guy. I used to subscribe to three newspapers. I only just stopped a few weeks ago. But look, the problem is not that, you know, that there's churn in different industries. Some industries die, other industries rise up. The problem is that in the industries that are coming up, you don't have anything like the kind of good-paying jobs that you used to have. And that's not because a good-paying job is unthinkable. It's because the power relationship has changed. And the sad thing about it is that Democrats are the party we look to do something about that, not to blow it off or to excuse it as inevitable. I mean, this is who we used to look to do something about that. This is their historical role.
I agree. The power relationship has changed. It would be nice to get that power relationship back. But you look at some of these trends, and for example, you look at high school wages. The peak year for high school wages in America in inflation-adjusted real dollars was 1974. So we're on a 41-year trend in which those wages are down. And as much as I wish there was something that we could do to turn that trend around, I think it is very unlikely it's going to turn around.
But, Jim, Tom's book makes the point that when there were one of these battles, these two-way battles, instead of throwing in their lot with working people and balancing out some of that lopsided power relationship by pulling on the workers' end of the rope in the big tug of war, they just left them to their fate. The Democrats, the liberals in the United States left those workers to their fate rather than saying, well, we're going to help equalize that power relationship by pulling a little harder on this end of the rope. They didn't do it.
I guess my criticism of Democrats during this period is that wedded too much to the past and not preparing people for the future. I do think Bill Clinton did a lot of things for working people, the Family and Medical Leave Act, the Children's Health Program, college tuition tax breaks. He raised the minimum wage. We passed the Brady Law. Barack Obama did the health care bill. I believe the Dodd-Frank bill on finance reform was a huge undertaking that, you know, I think brought a lot more safety back to Wall Street. But I feel that these problems that we have dealing with globalization and technology and demography in this country, these are the most difficult problems. The solutions aren't real easy. They involve making choices that sometimes are hurting particular interest groups and some democratic interest groups. So they're not as easy as the problems were. Our economic growth in this country has averaged 1.9% since 2001. That is the slowest growth rate over 15 years in our history. So these problems are very, very difficult. I don't think it's that Democrats abandoned them. I think these problems are more difficult to solve than in the past, and they involve choices.
Here's a comment from our website, onpointradio.org. Brandon writes, I wouldn't say that Democrats gave up on working people, but that working class people somehow got convinced that they are poor because they pay too much taxes. And for the older white people, they've gravitated toward blaming other poor people for their problems instead of looking at the very wealthy people who are actually harming them. From Twitter, Hoodoo Nola writes, agreed, no difference between GOP and Dems anymore. They've colluded in the neoliberal agenda that manufactures poverty here and abroad. Stefano writes on onpointradio.org, the Democratic Party is so frustrating. I love the FDR Dems, but I would never align myself with today's Democratic Party. So soft, so reactive, so PC. Please grow a backbone. We'll be back with more calls after the break. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This On Point podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you have a passion that you obsess over, if it keeps you up at night, if you live for it, you should show it off. With easy-to-use tools and templates, Squarespace helps you showcase every detail of what drives you. Because if it's worth the effort, it's worth showing to the world. Start your free trial today. Visit squarespace.com/onpoint. That's squarespace.com/onpoint. Squarespace.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the way forward for the Democratic Party. You can join the conversation. If Democrats went back to old-school liberal policies, would it be able to mend this economy and rebuild the American middle class? Or does this country need to go full steam ahead into the new global free trade high education economy? Annalisa is calling from Green Bay, Wisconsin. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I want to say that I do agree with much of what is being said here, and there were many times when I wondered if Bill Clinton really was a Democrat. But I want to bring up this issue of what happened in the Democratic Party. As I recall, there were a number of working class people who left the Democratic Party over the issue of race, and I believe they were called Reagan Democrats. And apparently the party has not been able to lure them back, but I just like Thomas Frank's opinion about that. Thank you.
Thanks for your call, Annalisa.
You might recall, Ray, I wrote a book about this some years ago called "What's the Matter with Kansas?" But in what the caller says is exactly right. But it was more the Nixon Southern strategy that she's describing. And yes, that really happened in Kansas. It was more the culture war issues were the things that were bringing working class people over to the Republicans. Can I say something else? You were talking about what we might do to turn things around. What are the policy options? What things are available to the president to turn the inequality trend around? And it's not that hard to come up with things. The first thing is Obama could have broken up the Wall Street banks when he had the chance, when he had the opportunity, you know, when the bailouts were going. He could also start enforcing antitrust laws again. You know, we have these laws. They're on the books. He could do this without Republican Congress, by the way, if he was just decided that we're going to start enforcing the law of the land again like we did in the 60s and 70s. And the last thing is, you know what would really change the trend towards inequality, completely reverse it, would be if you had a union organizing wave in this country like you did in the 1930s. And I mean, you know, people in businesses, you know, large and small, signing up to be part, you know, to bargain collectively with management. It would really change things.
Jim Kessler?
Look, I think the formula is more skills, more jobs, and more wealth for people. So I think we need a skills revolution that starts from pre-K through worker training. You know, it's not just access to pre-K, but higher quality that also helps parents make the home a learning environment. We need to reduce the dropout rates in colleges, which are now 40% for four-year schools. We need to invest in roads and ports and bridges and rails and airways and the energy grid and do research that will create jobs and more economic growth. And I think we need to trim the cost of healthcare to make room for paychecks to grow. And I think we should require every job to have a minimum pension contribution so that, you know, when you're as a kid working at McDonald's or whether you're an adult, you're getting some private pension to go on top of your Social Security. I think there's other ideas as well, but I think those are some things that will that will help make people's lives better and have a brighter future for the country and for people.
You're chuckling there, Thomas Frank, yeah, that's art of the possible policymaking.
Yeah. No, you can...
We don't have a Congress with 435 Democrats.
A skills revolution? Look, there's people here in D.C. always talk about the skills gap and skills mismatch. The problem is not that we don't have enough skills. If that was the problem, wages would be going up. The classic problem when a company can't find workers with the skills they need, they offer more money. Wages go up. That is not happening. That hasn't happened for a long time. Productivity still goes up in this country. Wages do not. Okay, we have plenty of skills. We don't, I mean, look, one of my larger critiques of the Democratic Party is that, you know, because of this self-absorbed class background that they all come from, they see every economic problem as an education problem. And what I'm saying is that it's not. It's a problem of power.
Well, I think, look, the situation here is that we've had manufacturing jobs in this country. If you look at it from 1940 to 2014, we've had between 18 and 25 million manufacturing jobs in this country. And we're at the lower end of that right now. We're at about 19 million. But that's the band that we've been in for 70 years. And if we have a manufacturing renaissance in this country, we'll probably get a few more million more manufacturing jobs. But if we haven't been broken out of the 18 to 25 million band for the last 70 years. I don't think we're going to break out of it in the next 70 years either. So, you know, whether you like it or not, people are going to have more skills and be more adaptable in this workforce. People are jumping from job to job. You talked about the task rabbit economy. I don't love that either, but there's a certain reality to that, especially for younger people. And you want them to be in a situation where they're more flexible.
Jim Kessler is the
skills is a bad thing in this world.
Jim Kessler is a senior vice president for policy of the centrist think tank Third Way. Thomas Frank is the author of Listen, Liberal, Whatever Happened to the Party of the People? And John is calling from Queensbury, New York. John?
Hi, Ray. How are you?
I'm okay.
I just wanted to make a comment. I don't understand where it's coming to, like, the millennial that called in that said that I can't find a good job or that pays, I should be making a living wage or whatever. When you just go out and work and you find a 40-hour job that pays $10 an hour, if it's not enough for you, get another job. I have a job. I started my own business. I work 40 hours a week for my employer, and I work 60 hours a week for myself because I'm not satisfied. I don't understand why it turns into not working for yourself and expecting more from somebody else. I mean, like the $15 minimum wage, if I had to pay $15 for the business that I own to pay employees $15, when I can afford to pay that, I will pay it. But right now I can pay $10 an hour. And if you're not a fool, in 2 months, I'll give you $12 an hour. But why not?
I think we lost John. Thomas Frank, that idea that you heard from Queensbury, New York, is one that is prevalent in the economy. I took it upon myself to change my circumstances, and one of our two main governing parties preaches that gospel and has for the last 40 years as an answer, as a riposte, as pushback to the idea that companies should pay a living wage.
Yeah, and do you remember when Reagan was president, he used to sort of sneer at the idea of unemployment because he could open up his newspaper and look, there's want ads in the paper, right? You can see that there are companies trying to hire people. Therefore, the idea of unemployment is ridiculous, and it puts no moral obligation on us. But the fact is that it does happen. You know, that unemployment does happen. There's, you know, lots and lots of people that can't find jobs, or there's people who do start their own businesses and their businesses fail. You know, or there's you know, I'll tell you one of the sort of awful story that I end Listen Liberal with, where some years ago I went and as a journalist covered a strike in Decatur, Illinois. And, you know, it was in the manufacturing sector, and, you know, it didn't end well for the workers, that is. I guess it ended well for shareholders, I suppose, but it didn't end well for the workers. I went back there last year to see how these guys were doing, and we talked about what it was like trying to get by in the economy the way it is now. You know, the society that they came up in, you know, you hired in at a factory or wherever, you were a member of the union and you got paid well, and you actually had retirement benefits because the union had negotiated them for you, and then, you know, and you would retire. And these factories are still there. They just don't, you know, these agreements aren't there anymore. And so they were telling me about, like, people retiring in poverty, you know, and having to go work at fast food restaurants in their retirement in order to make ends meet, you know. And that's the country that we're becoming. And you can't say to people like that, it's like, why don't you go out and start your own business? I have no moral obligation to you.
Earl,
you know, maybe
I'm sorry. Let's go back to the phones. Earl is calling us now from Dayton, Ohio, another city that has been on the wrong end of this new economic relationship in manufacturing. Earl, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray.
Hi.
I wanted to share with you, I am a GM retiree, and the reason I'm saying I'm a GM retiree is I was able to get out as the bankruptcy was going down. I actually retired in 1995 after 30 years at General Motors. One of the comments was just made is not correct here in the Dayton, Ohio area. There was multiple General Motors plants throughout the area, making appliances, making automotive parts and assembly parts and so on, including making the S10 pickup truck. Every General Motors plant in the Dayton, Ohio area including Kettering and Moraine, are gone. Not only are the workers gone, but the buildings are gone. There's only one plant left that I'm aware of in Moraine, what used to be called Moraine City. It's called Moraine now. It is now in existence only because a Japanese company bought it to start making windshields. And when I was getting ready to retire, I believe it was 1994, I heard from my union at that particular time, which was the IUE, that we have to nest it, we have to nest it. That was the slogan that was going around. I wasn't comfortable with it at the time, but because I was, you know, involved with my union, as far as a blue-collar worker, by the way, I was not a union rep or anything like that. I agreed with, we have to nest it, because I thought that's, you know, our union has had, they've had to study this, and they know what, they have to know what they're talking about, so I thought. And I agree with the person who called in a few minutes ago. I'm not too sure Clinton was Democrat either. And that's why at this particular time, I'm Democrat at heart, but I don't know how to vote anymore. I campaigned for Obama. I watched when I had a 32-year-old pickup truck from 1978, when they started giving cash for clunkers, my truck, when it was on leaded gas, getting less than 10 mile a gallon did not qualify. That didn't make sense. My mother, who was a GM retiree's spouse at the age of 93 at the time when General Motors went bankrupt, guess what happened to her? And she was relying on her pension and my dad's retirement in order to make it till she died at the age of 96. And she ended up having to go on Medicaid.
Earl, thanks a lot for your call from Dayton, Ohio. I want to get one more call on this hour, so I'm just cutting you off. I'm really sorry. Mike is joining us from Denver, Colorado. Mike, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ray. I am a lifelong Democrat, and it does pain me to see the economic problems that people are dealing with. But I remember when Walmart prided itself on Made in America. And it obviously is a store of choice for many lower-income people. And in the pressure to lower prices, they ended up buying more and more of their stuff from China. Their customers continued to buy that. Were they not committing economic suicide because their manufacturing jobs were going away at the same time they're buying Chinese products?
But their wages weren't going up, even if they continued working. I understand your point entirely, Mike. Jim Kessler, it's a pretty tough nut for middle-class workers.
It is. It's a middle-class job. Less and less is buying a middle-class life. I think it is a crisis in America. And like I said, I think it is the hardest public policy problem to solve these days. Look, I think one of the things we need to do as a country is we need to export more to other places. We look at the 40 largest economies in the world. The United States ranks 39th in the percentage of its GDP that is derived from exports. We are really a laggard in that area. And I agree with people who feel that NAFTA did not deliver the goods. But I would also say this, you know, that is a more than a 20-year-old trade law, and you're not going to buy, you know, you're not going to buy a 1993 car or a 1993 computer. Trade deals have changed since then. We actually learned some lessons from NAFTA, thankfully. We've done 17 trade deals since. In those trade deals, in the aggregate, in those 17 countries, we went from a $3 billion trade deficit in the goods sector, the blue-collar goods sector, to a $31 billion trade surplus. So it's because we put labor standards in there and environmental standards and other things. And I feel the next place we have to do is make a trade deal that is with Asia, because if we don't do it, China's going to set the rules there, and that's going to be very bad for us. So I think one of the things we need to do is sell more of our stuff overseas, so you get Made in America in stores in China, as opposed to Made in China in stores in the United States.
From OnPointRadio.org, Robin Wood writes, "Free trade has allowed U.S. companies to increase sales all over the world. It's lifted 500 million people out of poverty. It adds $1 trillion a year to U.S. purchasing power via lower-priced goods. We all benefit, even those who lose a job. There needs to be and are programs to retrain those workers to work in more promising fields. We've got about a minute left, Thomas Frank. That's been the bargain offered to American working class.
Yeah, it's a complete failure, and people know it now. It was in the New York Times just yesterday. We can see the history of how these trade deals. Look, the trade deals were structured to benefit one class of Americans. Everything's cheaper, you know, all that sort of. They have all sorts of power, and to harm another class of Americans. This is not a mystery. This is what they do, and it's right down to the present. The Trans-Pacific Partnership. Look, I want to point out two things.
Quickly,
first of all, is that the Democrats have constantly sided with the winners in the new economy. That's who they are, right? The creative class. They have no problem with growing inequality. That's who the Democrats are today.
And I want to mention that along with a really tough critique of the parties, your take on education and how education has created a new class and a set of benefits for a new class is a really must-read part of this book. Thomas Frank, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me, Ray.
Thomas Frank is the author of Listen, Liberal. It's been great to have him with us. Jim Kessler, good to talk to you.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Jim Kessler is co-founder and senior vice president for policy of the Democratic think tank Third Way. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, growing numbers of Americans say they do not strongly identify with a religion. We'll ask during this Holy Week for Christians what that means for the country. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.